F2. Number 19B.
And so he teaches them in the second letter how to work it out. That day of Christ is a state of consciousness in which we really are so filled with the Christ man that the Adam man has no more grip on us. He combines here in this epistle that expression of the day of Christ also with the recurring term of the righteous judgment of God. He says that day of Christ, that state of demonstrated perfection, cannot come before the righteous judgment of God is come. Under the righteous judgment of God, he understands that everything will be annihilated which is not godlike. Therefore he says, we cannot demonstrate finally that we are the idea, the perfect idea man, until everything in us which is not idea-like, ideational, but until everything which is not of that nature has gone away out of our consciousness. So because of that, you see, he says, that son of perdition within us, that Adam, that son of perdition has to go. And whenever you think of Second Thessalonians, you just think about these few points. It's the demonstration of the day of Christ, that is of a demonstrated sense of manhood, which can only come through the righteous judgment of God, which is to get rid of the son of perdition, the falling away of the son of perdition. He said that the day of Christ really cannot come until any withholding influence be taken away from us, that everything of the nature of Adam-likeness within us, of sinfulness within us, has not fallen away. Quite clear, the corruptible cannot inherit the incorruptible. So the corruptible man can never really be lifted up into the incorruptible man. All that has to be done is to put away the corruptible man. And he calls that man, that Adam man, the son of perdition, the man of sin. He says, for that day shall not come. That day, he means the day of Christ, you see. Therefore, that day where we really demonstrate our perfection cannot come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. And then explains the son of perdition, who opposes and exalteth himself above all that is called God. Therefore, all that must be put away within us, which says, I can live without God. I am God myself. Who opposes and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he, as God, sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. So he really defines here that claim of the second record of creation, that man is like God. That man must go. That's the son of perdition. So you can see that Second Thessalonians just goes a little step further than First Thessalonians. See, every epistle just goes just one little step further. And in First Thessalonians we just saw, well, we must claim, you see, we must claim our sonship with God, as we claim our sonship with God, that has an effect on the human plane. It begins to leaven the sense of man on the human plane, and begins to demonstrate a higher sense of humanhood. But how long, as Jesus said, shall we go on demonstrating a higher sense of humanhood? He said, the Son of Man must go. We can't always be there where we just repair and repair and repair what has gone wrong. He sees we must go further, to that state where we demonstrate man as the idea of God. But he can see that that can never be attained until the Son of Perdition goes entirely. The Son of Perdition must go entirely. It is that point when Jesus explained that to the disciples, that that is really the mission of Christianity, then it is said, and they walked no more with him. They couldn't stomach it. They walked no more with him and turned away from him. The human mind within us may like the signs of being, but only as far as it helps to improve the human. But when it comes to 2 Thessalonians, where it says you have to lay down the mortal and the human, then the disciples say, nothing doing with me, I walk no more, I don't go any more further. That's the end. And the Thessalonians didn't want to go on either. And so Paul had to urge them to go on. No matter how much difficulties they may encounter, that was just the only method possible for them to work out their salvation. So let's see how we could, in the law, reduce that message. I try to epitomize it like this in the law, that by our steadfastly abiding in the faith of man's perfection, the true idea man establishes itself in us. I think if I would write it today, I already would write it a bit more explicit, though it's still the same tone. I think in the elements, you see, in the elements I did it on page 136, which is a bit more explicit, really. That as we steadfastly abide in our conscious unity with the perfect idea man, mortal manhood is overthrown. See, the Son of Perdition has to go. See, that's Christianity. Can you see? Christianity as Christianity. Christianity has to do with man. Christianity as Christianity is the demonstration of man over mortal man. Can you see that? All right. So we see that that overthrows the mortal manhood in us, the Son of Perdition. And that, naturally, in the measure as the mortal manhood is overthrown in us, really the true idea of man is unveiled. You see, I was reminded the other day about this process, what we are doing, that we are really not creating in this week the true sense of science, the true sense of man. But all what we do with these laws is that we lose a misunderstanding of being. We are not really creating or constructing the true sense of being. All what we do is to rend the veil that tries to veil the true idea which exists forever and ever. See, Mrs. Eddy must have asked once in a class the students, what do you think what happened at Jesus' resurrection? Was Jesus after the resurrection more spiritual or less material? And so most students said he was more spiritual. And actually she said, oh no, he was less material. You see, that's what we are doing this week. Oh, we can't be more spiritual. We only can be less materially minded. Because all what we do is to work with the Spirit of God. That Spirit which Paul says has given as a pledge into your heart. That Spirit we don't have to build up or to acquire. That's the mystery of the Christ, that the idea has always existed. What we have to do is to get away from the Adam dream, to wake up from the Adam dream. Therefore, what we do with these laws and with this study is to rid ourselves of a misunderstanding. Then the true idea is just unveiled. You say unveiled when the veil is taken away. See, taken away. See, there is grace. We must see that all is grace, that we have it, that fundamentally we all have it. Fundamentally we all have it. What is necessary is to take away that veil. And that's what he shows here. Fundamentally we are the demonstrated idea of man. All what is necessary is to take away the son of perdition. That which says it isn't so. That which does not want to see man as he is. But man is always as what he is. So, let's see, you see, that what he says, that if we really stand by, unwaveringly stand by the idea of man as the idea of God, that carries within itself the power of demonstration, namely the power that rids ourselves of the son of perdition. So, in these epitomes here, which you have on page 133, more or less, I didn't try to be too systematic, too mechanical about it, and too schematic about it. I tried in the first paragraph of every synonym to show that first element, you see, of standing in the faith to the true idea, and in the second paragraph always showing what that quality carries within itself in order to get rid of the false concept. In mind, he shows us, you see, that through practicing unreservedly, I always try to take more or less a new term to bring out that C, A, B, C, you see. Here it's unreservedly, that's holding fast. Through practicing unreservedly the divine law, the righteous judgment of God comes to pass. This, if we do that, if we are really unreservedly practicing the divine law, the law of mind, that carries within itself, you see, to get rid of the son of perdition. That carries within itself to clear away unlawfulness within ourselves. To clear away what he describes there as disobedience and resistance to the law, as taking vengeance on them that know not God. You see, it takes away within us that not knowing God. That's the son of perdition. The counterfeit of mind. Can you see that? It's practicing unreservedly the law of mind that rids ourselves of the unlawfulness of mortal mind. In spirit, we have other qualities. He tells the Thessalonians to abide unwaveringly in the purity of spirit. And that if we do that, we begin to reflect the glory of the Christ. Spirit has to do with purity, with reflection, you see. It just takes these ideas of spirit. We could have taken any other idea of spirit. Just say, if you abide by the idea that you are the idea of spirit, that then begins to glorify you, and so that you are admired in all them that believe. But that has the power of Christianity in itself to destroy something, to destroy that which is unlike man. And so he shows them that it begins to destroy all unbelief, and that they shall be punished with everlasting destruction. You see, you get now the sense of understanding destroys misunderstanding, destroys belief. In soul, he shows that by steadfastly holding on to our unity with Christ, that the sinless manhood is established within us. But that carries within itself, you see, the power of Christianity to destroy something, to get rid of something. Namely, if we really identify ourselves unwaveringly with the true idea of man, that rids us of the man of sin, the son of perdition, and it disidentifies us from mortal manhood. Can you see? Always the opposite. Always the opposite. Then let's take principle. Here again, you see that see firmly abide. If we firmly abide by the true teaching of Christ, you see, principle is that which interprets itself, which teaches. Teaching is an idea of principle. It's expressed in the Bible as by the Spirit of the Lord's mouth. You see, the mouth is that which interprets, which speaks, which teaches. That's the biblical terminology for interpretation, the Lord's mouth. It will become a great spiritual power in us, he shows them. Such a great power that this power carries in itself the power of Christianity, that it does destroy within us all that is not principle-like. So it says, it renders ineffective all those other doctrines, which he calls the mystery of iniquity that already is at work, that wicked one, the working of Satan. He has quite a few expressions in this paragraph to depict the wicked one, you see, the counterfeit of the interpretation of principle, the working of Satan. So our working and being one with what principle is and what principle interprets to us has in itself really that power to free us from all those doctrines of men, all deceivableness of unrighteousness, as he says it. Then it takes life. Now life is the Father, the eternal Creator. And he takes that idea and shows that if we meekly stand fast, see, and you have again the sea, but we just have to stand to the true idea of the eternal fact that there is an eternal Father, then that eternal Father works in us to build up the true sense of life and of fatherhood in us. And that naturally overcomes something in us. It overcomes that sense that we are a creator, that man is a creator, that we can create something. That is overcome. That son of perdition which says, I am a creator, I can create what I like to create, I can do everything out of myself, instead of seeing that we can only create by reflection, that the real creator is the eternal Father, and only through our unity with the eternal Father we begin to reflect fatherhood, and therefore that sense of being always a creator to the universe, a helper to the universe, a maintainer and supporter to the universe, a sustainer to the universe, and so on. Then in truth, he takes the idea of truth and says and shows that if we unreservedly claim the consciousness of Christ as our manhood, that patient waiting for Christ, you see, He naturally has his own expression, you see. I usually take in the Christian Science terminology, but I usually give the way how Paul expresses it, you see. The patient waiting for Christ. What is the patient waiting for Christ? We would call that, you see, the consciousness of Christ, the awareness of the Christ, the constant consciousness of truth. That's the patient waiting for Christ. Then the word of Christ will have free course, as he says, and will be glorified. But that has in itself, again, you see, a power to destroy the Adam within us. It delivers us, as he says, from the unreasonable and wicked man. See, the false consciousness, the Adam consciousness, the wicked consciousness, the unreasonable consciousness. It's not the consciousness of truth. And then, finally, in love, says, well, if we abide with quietness, see, love is rest, is peace. If we abide with quietness in our faith and are not weary in well-doing, we had that before in Thessalonians in love, we are not weary in well-doing, you see, steadfastly, not giving in, that's again the sea, in well-doing, in always keeping the perfect idea in view, that establishes true practical Christianity. And then he says, well, that really rids us from that false sense of Christianity, of that false sense of being busybodies everywhere, and of leading a useless and an aimless life. Christianity is a purposeful life, because love is purpose. Love has plans, love has aim, you see. So Christianity as love is purposeful. It's not an aim, vain, purposeless life. But one just takes every day as it comes. You know, it's so nice. That's the Thessalonians. They say, well, we just take everything as it comes. We know that heaven is ours. That's the danger. See, it's true. It's true. But that is only the standpoint of Colossians. Well, we have to stand for that thing, that we take every day as it comes and that we know that salvation is ours. But let's put everything into it. Then it demonstrates itself, because only as we put everything into it, the opposite goes out of us. The opposite gets rid of us. It's that aimless, purposeless living, which just takes it so easily and so nicely and so restfully until one sleeps and gets slumber and then bang, you know. It has no more that vigor of life in it, which just has an aim, a purpose. And love is really that, you see, which works towards one ultimate purpose. Love really is telefinalistic, you see. That's what the true sense of love is, that it's absolutely telefinalistic. It starts and just works on a strict line to that final purpose. Didn't you get the word? The new word. Telefinalistic. Isn't that the word? Oh, yes. T-I-L-E. T-E-L-E. Oh, yes, you. Telefinalistic, yes. Telefinalistic. Yeah. So, he really tells these Thessalonians that they should let go of that son of perdition, you see. So let's ask what is necessary really to let go of that son of perdition. Well, he says, what is that son of perdition, you know? It isn't that who just goes wild from time to time. It's every counterfeit of the idea of mind and the idea of spirit, the idea of soul, that really is the son of perdition. It's what he shows in the first subject, that son of perdition is our willingness, really, to be active in the faith, to accept the laws of Christ. That's the son of perdition. In spirit, he says that son of perdition is really that which is unwilling to nurture the true faith, which is unwilling to take signs as understanding instead of just the belief. Says that son of perdition is really that sense which is unwilling to identify to that unwillingness to identify ourselves constantly with only that which is godlike, instead of identifying ourselves with all sorts of things, with depravity and unintelligence and a lack of faculties and lack of understanding and I don't know what. And he said in principle, well, that son of perdition is really the unwillingness to accept the teaching of principle as what principle is, to be unwilling to accept principle through its interpretation as system. Then in life, he says, that in us is really the son of perdition, which thinks, I'm a big boss, I'm a big shot, I can do everything better than the other one because I can do things. See, which makes the I the creator and the source of intelligence and everything. I mean the mortal I, not the divine I. Or in truth, he says, the son of perdition within us is really that which resists the appearing, the disappearing of false manhood, which just does not want false manhood to let go, which tries to save material manhood, which tries to save everything which belongs to the Adam. That's the son of perdition within us as the counterfeit of truth. And as the counterfeit of love, really he shows that it is that which would like to have heaven on earth without consecration, without sacrifice, without service. So often we would like to have heaven on earth without doing anything for it. And so he says, no, you can't do it. The day of Christ will not come until the righteous judgment of God has come. Without the son of perdition has to go. So really, you see, what he handles is a belief which is very widespread today, namely that sense of that metaphysical absolutism, which just seems to get hold of the Western civilization. It remained nicely silent in the East, but now it just seems to spread over the Western world. And it always does when great crises come on an individual or a nation or on the world. When people just feel they can't solve their human problem, they resort to metaphysical absolutism, because that's the easiest way you can do it. You just put your head up into the clouds and then don't see anything anymore. And so the Thessalonians did the same. They were persecuted and they had a rough time and a hard time. And so all they could think of was, well, it doesn't matter, in a few months the Christ will come again and will take us up into heaven. So Paul had to intervene and show them that any metaphysical absolutism by itself isn't worth a penny, that the absolute must have a Christ, and therefore that the absolute must be a savior to the human, and therefore have a Christ, and therefore be translated on the human plane, and that on the human plane we have to accept and receive these absolute facts in spite of the human.